Wuhan, China sets the bar high, testing 11 million people for COVID-19 in 10 days. Also today on The World, the coronavirus isn't just a threat to humans. Scientists are also worried about gorillas.
They'll definitely show the same signs, coughing, difficulty breathing. And what will make it much worse is that gorillas can't social distance.
And security experts worry what bioterrorists could learn from the coronavirus outbreak.
Look at the havoc that it's causing. It will plant the seed in the minds of bad guys that this is an effective way to harm the world.
And climate advocates debate whether slow and steady progress is the best way forward.
Or might there actually be more opportunity in a polarized political system where once in a while the pro-climate actors seize control of power and really try and push forward?
Those stories today here on The World. It is back. That is a headline from Wuhan, China. A handful of newly confirmed cases of the coronavirus have been reported in Wuhan this week. This follows more than a month of no confirmed local infections. The new cases have the Chinese government moving forward today with a sweeping new plan of mass testing, a lot of testing. All this while top U.S. scientists are raising alarm bells over the need for a more aggressive response here. The World's Ilana Gordon covers global health for our program. Let's start with Wuhan, Ilana. What exactly is going on there?
So the plan, Marco, is to test 11 million people in 10 days. Li Kuan is a resident of Wuhan, and here's what he told the BBC.
Just this morning, I filled out the form online to apply for the free test, and it's for every people here in Wuhan.
It's not totally clear just how this massive testing will happen. And it's also, Marco, unclear whether, honestly, asking everybody to come out of their homes to get a test is going to be the most effective response. And so countries like China, they're trying to find a path out right now.
In terms of paths out of this pandemic, how does that compare to responses here in the United States?
Well, first, the U.S. has appeared to be in a place that does not have nearly that much capacity as China to test everyone in such a short period. But one tracker project found that testing in the U.S. does appear to be going up. The daily numbers now are double daily compared to last month at more than 300,000 tests a day. Still this week, Marco, the urgency and the concerns about the U.S. response and the coordination, that really ramped up in a Senate hearing on Tuesday and a House hearing today. Dr. Rick Bright, until recently, he headed the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Agency. He has said that he recently was ousted for not standing behind a controversial, unproven treatment for coronavirus. He testified. He sat next to this canister of disinfectant wipes. He then pulled down his mask when responding to questions, and this is what he said.
There will be likely a resurgence of COVID-19 this fall. It'll be greatly compounded by the challenges of seasonal influenza. Without better planning, 2020 could be the darkest winter in modern history.
That sounds ominous. Does Dr. Bright mean dark as in death and sickness this year?
Yeah, I mean, people are getting restless right now to leave their homes. I mean, we have to go to work. What he's saying is the healthcare system, though, still right now is already being taxed to the limit, and the virus is still spreading.
Yeah, so short of an effective vaccine that everyone can receive, Ilana, what does it mean to get through the pandemic?
There are possible scenarios. And yesterday, Mike Ryan, he's director of health emergencies at the World Health Organization, he said it's important to be realistic about this new coronavirus. And one path and outcome is that it could, frankly, be with us for a long time.
This virus may become just another endemic virus in our communities, and this virus may never go away.
I don't think he meant that as a sort of defeatist statement, because the patterns of a virus and the degree and magnitude of its spread, all of that does rest, he stressed, in how the world and how nations and communities respond. And also, let's not forget individuals in terms of the basics of hand washing and social distancing.
The World's Ilana Gordon on the Global Health Beat for the show. Thanks very much for getting us started.
You're welcome, Marco.
We've all seen things on Facebook that bother us, even anger us or make us cry, but consider what content moderators have seen. Those are the people who review and remove graphic and disturbing posts so you and I don't have to see them. They say their work has given them PTSD and other mental health issues. In a new settlement, Facebook is agreeing to pay moderators here in the U.S. $52 million. There are thousands more moderators worldwide. The World's Lydia Emanuelidou reports on what this new agreement could mean for them. And just a heads up, parts of this story are disturbing, so take care while listening.
A few years ago, Chris Gray got a gig as a content moderator for Facebook. He lives in Dublin, Ireland.
When you, as a Facebook user, when you see something that you don't like and you report that, it ends up on my desk and I have to look at it and see if it should be allowed up according to Facebook's rules.
There was a wide range of posts landing on Gray's desk or screen for him to review.
I would see arguments, fights between people, racist jokes, nudity. And then at the extreme end, you know, child abuse, people for sale, murders being live streamed. I mean, just all kinds of terrible, awful stuff.
Gray had to look through hundreds of these posts every day and make really quick decisions about what to do with them, to leave them up or take them down. He couldn't talk about the work he was doing with anyone, not even his wife, because he was under a strict NDA, a non-disclosure agreement. Gray wasn't employed by Facebook itself, but as a contractor through this Dublin-based company called CPL Resources. And this is really common. Facebook outsources most of its content moderation work to third-party companies like this one. Gray only lasted on the job for a few months, and it wasn't until after he left CPL, he says, that he realized the toll the work had taken on his health.
I started to have all these memories of you know, terrible graphic violence, murders, beheadings, child abuse, all this stuff. And I pretty much had a breakdown.
Shortly after that, Gray was diagnosed with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And then late last year in December, he and other content moderators sued Facebook and CPL Resources in Ireland's High Court over the psychological trauma they say they endured on the job. They allege they didn't get proper training and that there weren't adequate mental health resources at work. So as this lawsuit in Europe moves forward, people involved with the case say they're closely watching Facebook's settlement with content moderators here in the U.S. In a preliminary settlement, Facebook agreed to pay damages to American moderators and provide more counseling on the job.
So what we've seen is that after kind of years of holding out their workforce of content moderators at arm's length, Facebook is at least trying to take some responsibility for the mental health of some of its content moderators.
Corey Kreider is with the London-based nonprofit Foxglove. She's a lawyer helping out with the lawsuit in Ireland. She says she's not at all impressed with the amount Facebook has agreed to pay out to U.S. content moderators.
Look, this is one of the world's wealthiest companies, and $52 million is a quarter in the parking meter for them.
But she says what's most important is Facebook's acknowledgement that they have some responsibility for the health of the people doing work on their behalf.
That part, you know, one can take around, and I would put it in front of a court pretty much anywhere and say, look, if they take responsibility for them in the States, they should take responsibility for them in India. They should take responsibility for them in South America. They should take responsibility for them in Europe. Absolutely, that's the case.
It's not just Facebook that relies on these mostly low-wage workers to keep its platform, well, usable. All the big social media companies are outsourcing this work to an army of content moderators around the world, including in the Philippines. Manila, the capital, has become a hub for these centers, what some have likened to digital sweatshops. In the 2018 documentary, The Cleaners, one content moderator there recounts the first time she saw child pornography. It was a video she was reviewing.
Which is really, I don't know, unforgivable for me to see. So I went straight to my team leader and told him that I can't do this. I really can't do this. I can't look at the child. But then he told me that I should do it because this is my job and I signed the contract for it.
Advocates are working hard to make sure people like this woman, who are on the front lines of keeping the internet safe, have more resources to protect themselves. And they hope that what's happening in the U.S. sets a precedent for workers in even more precarious situations outside of this country. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
One more note on this. We reached out to Facebook for comment, but did not hear back by our deadline. Italy's agriculture minister Teresa Bellanova fought back tears today as she unveiled an amnesty plan for migrant workers.
Per me, per la mia storia, è un punto fondamentale.
The new decree allows thousands of undocumented migrants in Italy to work in agriculture and home care for up to 6 months. Matteo Salvini, the leader of Italy's far-right League Party, accused Bellanova of crying for migrants when she should be helping Italian citizens in need. The amnesty helps fill a big gap of seasonal workers who have gone back to Eastern Europe because of the pandemic. Cesare Fermi is with Intersos. They provide emergency relief to Italy's informal laborers. And Fermi says the amnesty doesn't go far enough to protect Italy's migrant workers.
What came out is just something that is a compromise that is not really solving the situation.
Take us to those fields. I mean, you've been out there and in some of these informal settlements where these workers live and work. Describe their conditions.
So we work in Apulia, the biggest agricultural area in Italy, in the southern part, for sure. In the highest peaks, we have around 7,000-8,000 people that are scattered in many informal settlements that are known like the ghetto. The conditions there are absolutely at the lowest level of humanity, in the sense. A refugee camp in Africa is basically the same. We provided just 10 days ago, for the very first time, the availability of drinkable water to this settlement for the first time. This was possible thanks, I can say, of course, it's not the right expression, but thanks to the epidemic of the virus in Italy that forced the local authorities to move. But before this, there was no even drinkable and running water there. The situation is harsh. There is a huge problem of criminality. People there is exploited for real by a system that is not only local, it's not only on the shoulder of the agricultural entrepreneurs, but is, of course, well established among the local mafia and with the role of the, we call caporali, so caporals, so the intermediary figures that are in the middle of the job market, that is a very well and strong established criminality. So basically the country is trying to put a patch. It is only 6 months.
So you said the government is putting a patch on the problem. Would you characterize this move more as salvation for the Italian economy or is it salvation for the migrant workers?
We in Italy have a system that is economically based in agriculture on the exploitation of the people. This move is not recognizing this. This move is just, this law is just recognizing that there is a temporary need of labor work and a temporary possibility for people to be regular.
You've described some terrible conditions in these migrant camps in Italy, and yet they're providing so many of the products we pull from the shelves here in the U.S., all over the world. Practically all the canned tomatoes I buy are from Italy, the olives. What do these workers earn?
It depends on the season, but not more than 20, 25 euro per day.
Right. That's about $30 a day.
So when they go to work, they have to pay for frequently for food, they have to pay for water, they have to pay especially for transportation.
Cesare, what do you think is a better way forward for migrants working in Italy right now?
The best thing would be, as we are trying to do as a civil society, is to make really a reflection on what is the economical system, because this economy is based on irregular work, because everything is very well known. It's not, nothing is hidden, and nothing is in the shadow. It's, everything is under the sun.
Cesare Fermi directs migration programs for Intersos, an NGO that provides emergency relief to Italy's displaced population. He joined us from just outside of Rome. Cesare, thank you for your time.
Thank you for your attention.
Still ahead on the show, you get to meet the very funny anger translator for the First Minister of Scotland. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. Meaningful action for climate change takes more than good ideas. It takes political will. So what works to get politicians working together on the problem? That's today on our weekly climate solutions segment, The Big Fix.
We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
The only option that we have is to succeed.
What we do now and in the next few years will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
From Norway to Australia, Japan to Germany, our guest Mato Mildenberger looked at how politics shaped decades of climate policy for his new book, Carbon Captured. Mato, thanks for being with us. Why is thinking about the politics of climate so important? What lens does it offer that is missed when we focus on the technical challenges of solving climate change?
Collectively, countries around the world are not doing what it's going to take to solve the climate crisis. Too often, we focused on not having the right technologies to solve the problem or those technologies too expensive, neither of which is really true anymore. We know what we need to do, and it's cheap and profitable to do it. What matters is the politics of climate change now.
So you focused on Norway and Australia in your book. Why those two? And what did you learn about what works and what doesn't work when it comes to building political coalitions to address climate change?
In Norway, we have really early action. They really started having a carbon tax, a carbon price early in the 1990s. Whereas I think Australia has seen the most political conflict over climate change than basically anywhere in the world. But here's what you do learn. If we think about Norway, we think about Australia, and frankly, if we think about the United States, in all these countries, climate change actually disrupts some of the existing political coalitions that are out there. We have workers on the left who depend on carbon-intensive jobs, and we also have businesses that depend on carbon pollution. And the same is true on the right when we have more business-friendly parties. A lot of the conflict over climate change actually plays out within the left and within the right. It happens within existing political parties and coalitions.
Here in the U.S., though, it does feel really left and right. I mean, the U.S. has politicized climate change probably more than any country on earth. With the world's strongest economic power in that position, isn't that a huge barrier to action?
A possible upside of the type of polarization we see in the United States is that when the Democrats are in power, there might be more appetite to undertake the type of disruptive climate reforms that are necessary to really solve this problem at the scale that we need to. It's still an open question whether slow and steady incremental progress that works at the margins, is that going to be a better strategy? Or might there actually be more opportunity in a polarized political system where once in a while the pro-climate actors seize control of power and really try and push forward on this issue?
So we can talk about whether certain climate policies work from a technical perspective. But if we're talking solutions to climate change, what type of policies are the most politically successful?
For about 20 years now, carbon pricing has been one of the main tools in the climate policy toolkit. The idea of carbon pricing is that you in some way make companies and polluters pay for the costs associated with the harm they're doing from releasing this pollution into the atmosphere. From a political perspective, this is a really, really difficult policy. It makes consumer costs really visible, and the benefits of acting, all of the avoided climate catastrophe that's going to happen in the next 10 or 15 years, is totally hidden. And so I actually think that there's a lot of sense to foreground benefits and try and pass policies that are more like the Green New Deal, that really focus on providing economic opportunities to workers in new industries. That's really going to help generate a coalition that actively wants and desires change. And it's also going to help split apart workers and business who have previously been opposed to climate policies by giving workers in fossil fuel industries new opportunities that will sort of bring them into a pro-climate coalition.
So, Mato, what gives you hope for the future when it comes to political solutions to climate change?
If we look at the extraordinary response that's happened right now to the coronavirus pandemic, it's hopeful to think that the world can come together and sort of take the type of action they're taking on COVID right now, but applying it to the next big looming crisis. Go back a couple of months to the Democratic primary. Presidential candidates who were proposing a $1.5 trillion, $2 trillion climate plan over 10 years were dismissed as fanciful, and we've spent more than that in a couple of weeks under the CARES Act. I think that type of effort and renewed political response to crisis is happening all around the world. And if we can redirect some of those energies to the climate crisis, I think that we have a fighting chance over the 2020s to bring this problem under control.
Mato Mildenberger is a professor of political science at UC Santa Barbara. He's also the author of the new book, Carbon Captured. Thanks for being with us, Mato. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Next week on The Big Fix, we'll talk about flying, and we want to hear from you. How have your attitudes about flying changed because of the pandemic? Will you fly more once restrictions loosen up or less? Email us a voice memo to climate@theworld.org. That email address again, climate@theworld.org. We'll be back next Thursday with another report from The Big Fix. When lockdown restrictions first went into place, many business owners like Pete Loosemore reckoned with a harsh reality.
Our initial reaction was, oh dear, that's a shame. We won't be able to open this year.
Loosemore runs a Sturminster Newton Mill in rural Dorset in southwestern England.
It's not a big mill or anything like that, just a very small old water mill.
The mill, which is used to grind wheat into flour, was last fully operational in 1970. Since then, it's become a tourist destination, only producing flour a few days a month, a few months a year. But when the coronavirus hit, Loosemore saw an opportunity.
It became apparent that of all the things which were being scooped up in the supermarkets, flour was disappearing very quickly, and none of the local supermarkets or small stores had any flour left.
Loosemore knew he and his colleagues could run the mill while staying 6 feet apart, so they ramped up production and have been cranking out flour for some local bakeries. A day's work produces about 66 pounds of flour. Loosemore says the wheat comes from a local farmer who delivers a ton at a time, enough for the season.
But this year, we got through the first ton in about 2 weeks. We're well into our second ton of grain at the moment.
Loosemore, now 79, began helping out at the mill in 1994. His grandfather worked at the mill a century earlier, in 1894. Loosemore says the mill's history goes back even further than that.
Quite recently, only about 4 years ago, we found a large stone which had been covered in many, many layers of whitewash. We cleared it and cleaned it a bit, and this large stone had the date 1566 carved into it. So we guess that that's the last time the mill was largely rebuilt. But it's on a site which we know has been used for milling for something around about 1,000 years.
A mill that has lasted a millennium, now helping the town through a tough time.
There's so many people working very hard in the NHS and in care homes and so on, and this is, by comparison, a very small effort on our part, but it does help a little bit, and it's nice to be able to contribute in our own small way.
Loosemore says the plan is to keep milling flour until their services are no longer needed. The rest, he says, is out of his hands.
I just grind the flour. I leave the baking to other people.
You join us here every day because you know you'll get stories that give you a wider horizon of people and places around the world. Take a moment to share the stories that really stick with you. We're on Twitter, at The World. That's where you can find the stories you hear on the show, and you can connect with our journalists who reported them. We've got a brand new handle on Twitter. It's easier than ever to remember. We are at The World. Women's soccer or football has never been more popular. The fight to pay women players the same as men was making huge strides. Then the world stopped turning.
There is a bit of a worry, I think, that without those major events, football, women's football maybe falls a little bit off the pedestal that it's worked so hard to fight for.
Growing a sport when there are no sports, that's coming up here on The World. It's still unclear how the coronavirus outbreak got started, but also let's be clear, intelligence experts say there is no evidence that the virus was created in a Chinese lab or weaponized, as some in the Trump administration have claimed. Regardless, the allegations are a stark reminder that even though biological weapons were banned decades ago, the world is still vulnerable. Andy Weber is former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Nuclear, Chemical, and Biological Defense Programs under President Obama. He's now a senior fellow at the Council on Strategic Risks. Andy, how has the conversation around biological weapons changed since the outbreak of coronavirus?
Well, I've been concerned, as have a small group of people in and out of government for many years, that it was just a matter of time before we had a biological weapons attack. The coronavirus has shown the world what a biological attack, in this case a natural outbreak, can do. And if this had been a deliberate engineered attack by an illegal state bioweapons program, perhaps it would be much worse.
Can you just give us a sense of how big the threat actually is today?
It's been a very grave threat for a while, but what troubles me is that it's increasing because the technology to make biological weapons is getting more accessible and much cheaper over time. And this demonstration of the current pandemic will only increase the possibility, put ideas in minds. Look at the havoc that it's causing around the world, not just to people, but also to economies. it will plant the seed in the minds of bad guys that this is an effective way to harm the world.
And Andy, who do you and other experts believe an actual bio attack would come from? Extremist groups? Governments?
Well, there are two categories. There's what we call bioterrorism. So that would be extremist groups like ISIS that have been seeking biological weapons capabilities. But then there are the still lingering illegal state bioweapons programs. We know that North Korea has an advanced biological weapons program. We have concerns about Russia continuing elements of its once massive biological weapons program.
So we've been talking about bioweapons. What does biodefense look like?
Well, I think of biodefense broadly. It's a system of early warning detection of any type of disease outbreak, whether it's a deliberate attack or, as in the current case, a natural outbreak or accidental release. And then what you need is a rapid response capability that includes rapid diagnostics and the ability to quickly develop therapeutics and vaccines to treat and prevent the disease from spreading. So that's the key, is detection, then rapid response.
Right. And the Trump White House shut down the National Security Council's bioweapons branch and proposed cuts to the labs that would test for biothreats. And funding for civilian biosecurity has fallen 27% in the last 4 years. How concerned are you about the attention this administration is giving the problem?
Well, it disturbs me. We certainly built up our capabilities during the Obama administration. We lived through the H1N1 situation in 2009. We had grave concerns about North Korea's bioweapons program. We started a partnership to prepare for that with South Korea. And then, of course, we had the Ebola outbreak that I helped lead our response to in 2014 and 15. So we were very aware of it, created that special unit at the National Security Council to focus full-time on this. And both the funding and the organizational structures have atrophied during the last 3 years.
I guess we should say again that there is no evidence that coronavirus came from a Chinese lab, as some have claimed. But what lessons, Andy, should we be taking from the warning lights raised by COVID-19?
The big lesson is preparedness. And actually, I'm optimistic. At the Council on Strategic Risks, we've launched a program to make bioweapons obsolete. And we think by having a good system of early warning and applying biotechnology to rapid medical countermeasure response capability, we can actually convince countries that bioweapons won't work, they won't be effective, and in doing so, actually make them obsolete.
Andy Weber was the former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Nuclear, Chemical, and Biological Defense Programs under President Obama. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
A record-setting 1.1 billion people watched last summer.
It's a sellout at the Parc des Princes. Superstars everywhere you look. France and the
FIFA Women's World Cup in France last July. The soccer tournament marked a peak in popularity for the women's game and a peak in the fight for gender equity. But as the world's Bianca Hillier reports, the pandemic is putting both of those achievements at risk.
Calls for equal pay reverberated through the World Cup stadium in Paris last summer and the streets of New York City. As women's soccer was drawing more and more fans, the players were stepping up their fight against gender discrimination in the sport. But just a year later, the game's visibility and its journey toward equity has been stopped in its tracks.
Up until coronavirus, we saw that the game was absolutely exploding.
That's Amanda Vandervoort, the chief women's football officer at FIFPro, the World Players Union for Professional Soccer Players. Without games and tournaments, many of the factors contributing to the rise of women's soccer and the athletes' fight for equality have dissipated.
Sometimes, you know, you have to be really brutally honest about what is going on in the game.
In a recent report examining COVID-19's impact on professional women's soccer, FIFPro said the pandemic could present an almost existential threat to the women's game. One reason, according to FIFPro, 47% of female players don't have a contract with their clubs. Only 8% of male players face the same reality, according to a 2016 FIFPro report. A lack of contract means a lack of protection.
The downstream implications of that at a moment like coronavirus means that they might not be getting the support that they need or have contractual status that might prove absolutely critical when we're talking about labor negotiations and we're talking about people keeping their jobs.
Sarah Gregorius is a two-time Olympian who represented New Zealand in three World Cups.
Here we go. That's a great ball. Gregorius! New Zealand!
She's now retired from professional soccer and works for FIFPro as a policy and strategy officer. Gregorius pointed to another way the pandemic could disrupt the growth of women's soccer. The visibility that players get on world stages like the Olympics and World Cups, she said, is a pathway to sustainable employment, like getting picked up by a different team or getting a better sponsorship deal.
There is a bit of a worry, I think, that without those major events, if they keep getting postponed, if they keep getting pushed back, that football, women's football, maybe falls a little bit off the pedestal that it's worked so hard to fight for.
The unique impact that the coronavirus is having on women's teams can already be seen. In Colombia, the soccer club Independiente Santa Fe suspended its women's team, while its men's team is staying on staff. Notably, that club's women's team is ranked higher than the men's team in their respective groups. After last year's World Cup, FIFA announced it was investing $1 billion in the women's game. They say that's still the plan, but even $1 billion might not be enough.
To be quite blunt, the sports industry in general, without sport being played, is hemorrhaging money.
Gregoria says, on the whole, men's teams are losing more money than women's teams right now because their overall ad revenue was higher to begin with. So resources are being poured into preparing men's teams to resume playing as soon as possible.
And then the women, they get, I guess, a little bit shafted, and that's what we're trying to fight against.
Former Football Association director Dame Heather Rabbits says when you look at the numbers, it actually makes a lot of sense to prioritize getting women's teams back on television before men's teams. Women's games, she says, could be a more appealing option for advertisers who are facing tighter budgets.
If you are a media platform, a broadcaster, or a sponsor, women's sport is still commanding way less premiums than their male counterparts.
Dame Rabbits also says she sees women's ticket sales increasing post-pandemic due to the game's appeal to family values.
There's a real sense of the passion and professionalism of women's football without the same tribalism that we have in some of the men's game. And therefore, it has proven to be very attractive to families.
Dame Rabbits and FIFPro agree that even if the resources aren't there right now, it's important to keep women's soccer in the headlines to safeguard the momentum that athletes and advocates worked for years to build. Because despite the lack of games, the goal remains the same.
Lovely run! Great goal! Brilliant goal!
For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
For the United States!
Living through a pandemic is scary, but we also know that if we wash our hands, stay away from others, wear a face mask, we're pretty safe. For apes, though, there's no way to convey these messages. Scientists and researchers who care for apes are worried that the virus could be devastating for endangered populations. Dr. Gladys Kalema-Zikusoka is a veterinarian who oversees the health of the mountain gorillas at Bwindi Impenetrable National Park in Uganda.
We share over 98.4% genetic material with the mountain gorillas and can easily make each other sick. And that's why I was hired as a first veterinarian for the Uganda Wildlife Authority when gorilla tourism began, because it meant that people would get very close to gorillas and could easily give them a fatal flu like the coronavirus.
If a gorilla were to contract COVID-19, I mean, could they become as seriously ill as humans?
Yes, if a gorilla was to contract COVID-19, they'll become as seriously ill as humans, if not worse, as we've seen in the past, when they get a human disease. And they'll definitely show the same signs, coughing, difficulty breathing. What will make it much worse is that gorillas can't social distance. You know, they live in a family group where they move in a group of an average of about 10 to 15 gorillas through the forest, and they groom each other a lot. So once one gorilla gets it, the rest are inevitably going to get it, and we can lose a whole gorilla group.
What steps are being taken to protect them?
The park staff have to visit the gorillas every single day. Everyone's temperature has to be taken before they go in. And then on top of that, everyone has to wear a mask when they visit the gorillas, whether it's a surgical mask or a cloth mask. Everyone has to wear a mask.
Tourism revenue from visitors who want to see the gorillas counts a lot. What is the chain reaction to the whole ecosystem around the gorillas as that income dries up?
Yeah, there's been a big drop in income because of gorilla tourism being stopped because of the COVID-19 pandemic. And people are really struggling. Whereas they'll be able to sell accommodation and meals, people make crafts which tourists buy, they're all really suffering a lot. And so the things that we're trying to do as a non-profit and other groups and the Wildlife Authority itself, we're trying to look at alternative livelihoods that are not tourism dependent. We have a social enterprise called Gorilla Conservation Coffee that supports farmers living around the park. Once someone buys a coffee, there's a donation that goes back to the non-profit to continue to improve community health, gorilla health and conservation. Because when they don't have an income from tourism, they're likely to go into the park to look for food, to feed their families and to cut the trees.
Dr. Kalema Zikozoka, is your concern for the gorillas moving forward about how long they will need protection from the coronavirus? Or do you have longer term worries, even once it seems the coronavirus has been contained?
A big worry, of course, is it will always be the threat of human disease. It's an immediate threat for all habituated gorillas. But we need the tourists. The community needs the tourists because they need a sustainable source of income. When the tourists come, they provide an economic incentive that stops people going to the forest to poach. If a gorilla comes into their gardens, they won't kill it, they'll protect it because they know that this gorilla is bringing income for their family and taking them out of poverty. So where there's a lot of tourism for gorillas, in Bwindi and the Virungas, they're the only ones where the numbers are growing. Tourism is being seen as beneficial to gorilla conservation, but it has to be done very carefully.
Dr. Gladys Kalema Zikozoka is a veterinarian at Bwindi Impenetrable National Park in Uganda. She's also the founder of the nonprofit Conservation Through Public Health. Doctor, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
We've heard a lot about interrupted supply chains during the pandemic, but here's a worry we may not have considered: how to procure a daily ration of fresh bamboo for two giant pandas. This is the problem zookeepers in Calgary have been wrestling with during the pandemic. The pandas Da Mao and Ar Shun have been on loan from China since 2014. Calgary Zoo President Clément Lantier says he's watched the disruption to their food supply get worse and worse.
Bamboo doesn't grow easily in Canada. So from the start, we had to import bamboo, and we choose to import bamboo from China. For the last 2 years, it was going very, very well. And then we saw the direct flight from China to Calgary being canceled.
Lantier tried getting the supply of bamboo rerouted from China. Then he started trucking it in from Los Angeles. But that meant the bamboo spent a weekend in Vancouver on the way, where it got dried out. That the pandas would not stand for.
We have to provide fresh bamboo twice a week. Otherwise, it's not good enough for the panda.
Finally, the Calgary Zoo found a small supply of bamboo growing on Vancouver Island. But each panda needs nearly 90 pounds a day. So zookeepers decided it's time for the pair to return to China a few years earlier than expected. Canadian and Chinese authorities are working together to find Da Mao and Ar Shun a flight. Some Brexit news today. Yes, the UK leaving the EU is still a thing. A quick geography refresher. Northern Ireland is part of the United Kingdom. Today's news, goods entering Northern Ireland by sea will be checked, even goods coming from another part of the UK like England. That is quite a departure from a few months ago when British Prime Minister Boris Johnson told business leaders in Northern Ireland that they wouldn't have to worry about any new customs forms or extra paperwork. Britain and the European Union were supposed to be using this year to sort out the details of the post-Brexit relationship. But as the world's Orla Barry reports from London, that process has been overshadowed.
There was a time, not so long ago, when you could barely get through a day without hearing something like this from the British Prime Minister.
We can end the paralysis. We can transform our country with massive investments in health. Let's get Brexit done.
But Brexit has fallen way down on Boris Johnson's agenda. And it's hardly surprising. Britain now has the highest number of deaths from COVID-19 in all of Europe.
Honestly, it isn't something that I'm spending any time on personally at the moment because we've got this coronavirus to deal with.
That's Matt Hancock, the British Health Secretary. You might think, given the current circumstances, that the UK would ask the EU to delay Brexit talks, at least beyond the December deadline. But Hancock says there's no need.
The basis of the future arrangement is already set. There's no reason to delay. I think we should just get on with it.
And that means reaching agreement on a long list of issues, from freedom of movement and customs checks to fishing, aviation standards, and so much more. But the European Union is not convinced that Britain's heart is really in it. Here's the EU's Trade Commissioner, Phil Hogan, talking in Irish radio just a few days ago.
There's no real sign that our British friends are approaching the negotiations with a plan to succeed. And I hope I'm wrong. I don't think so.
British leaders, for their part, are laying the blame squarely on Europe. Andrew Bridgen is a Conservative Party MP and a staunch Brexiteer.
The problem for the European Union is that they are putting demands on the UK-EU trade agreement, which they've never placed on any other sovereign independent nation, such as Japan or Canada or South Korea, in that they're demanding a level playing field, which is code for the UK accepting EU rules and regulations as is and in the future.
Both sides now have less than 7 months to figure it all out. Some suspect that the British government might be holding out until the last minute, waiting for Europe to cave. After all, many Brexit deals in the past have only been reached at the 11th hour. Jill Rutter is with the think tank UK in a Changing Europe.
The UK thinks that the EU only ever moves when it's up against a deadline. And I think that's one reason why the UK is very reluctant to give any hint at asking for an extension.
But business leaders in Britain are worried. Uncertainty about the future of trade with the EU could not come at a worse time. Rutter says if no deal is reached by the end of the year, some industries in the UK will undoubtedly suffer.
And it's particularly bad news in some sectors who may face very high tariffs. So if you're a British sheep farmer and you want to export your lamb to the EU, you're going to face prohibitively high tariffs to do that.
For now, Boris Johnson says that come December 31st, Britain will be free of the European Union and all of its rules and regulations, no matter what. And in any case, Andrew Bridgen says the UK government has another card up its sleeve.
Also, we have opened negotiations with the United States of America. And if we could have a free trade deal with the USA, that's going to put considerable pressure on the European Union during these negotiations. It's now the time for the UK to play the Trump card.
President Trump has promised the UK a far bigger and more lucrative trade deal than the EU ever would. But a recent poll found that only about a quarter of the British public trusts that his administration would treat the UK fairly. It may be some time before we know which side really holds the Trump card. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
If you need a laugh, and don't we all, check out Scottish comic Janie Godley. Lately, she's been posting videos of Scotland's First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, except you don't hear the First Minister's voice. You hear Godley acting as a kind of anger translator, if you will, for the already no-nonsense Scottish leader. By way of contrast, here is the real Nicola Sturgeon a few days ago.
I will not be pressured into lifting restrictions prematurely before I am as certain as I can be that we will not be risking a resurgence of infection rates.
And here's how Janie Godley dubbed another recent press briefing by Sturgeon. She's comparing British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's lockdown relaxation measures versus Scotland's cautious approach.
It's like when you were a kid and your parents got divorced and one parent lets you stay up to 5 in the morning googling diddies and watching TikTok all night and sitting in the car park eating crisps and drinking ginger outside the pub, and the other parent's like, no, you have to wear your armbands in the swimming pool, you have to be in bed at 9 o'clock, you have to make sure that you eat your vegetables. Look, I hate being bad cop. I care more about you no dying than you no liking me.
I apologize if you don't exactly follow all the Scottish English. Still, even if you're picking up just a few scattered words, it's pretty hysterical. Here's another round of Janie Godley's overdubbing. In the clip, Scotland's First Minister is calling on a reporter at a press conference. But in this take, it's as if First Minister Nicola Sturgeon got a role in Trainspotting.
Right, we're going to go over to a journalist called Ben, and he's aye got his guitar, so let's see what he's got to say.
Nicola, what tune would you like me to play on my guitar? The request is yours.
Well, I was going to ask you to play 500 Miles by the Proclaimers, but we can't walk 500 miles. We've got to stay close. And I'll tell you something else. See this? I'm going to go sunbathing. Is that an exercise? When was lying on air beach on your arse an actual exercise? How many calories does that burn? None. So stay in the house. Right. See you all tomorrow at the same time. Thank you very much. Stay at home.
Even though we've got to stay inside, we'll honor your request today. Nicholas Sturgeon, played by comic Janie Godley. When I wake up, well, I know I'm going to be the man who wakes up next to you. When I go out, yeah, I know I'm going to be the man who goes along with you. If I get drunk, well, I know I'm going to be the man who gets drunk next to you. And if I heave up, yeah, I know I'm gonna be the man who's heaving to you. But I would walk 500 miles, and I would walk 500 more. A little Throwback Thursday for you from the Toast of Edinburgh, the Proclaimers. Always good to share a little laugh and some tunes with you. Here's one more way we can connect. Start your morning with a quick hit of news stories from around the globe. You don't have to go digging for it. Our team at The World will send it right to your email so you can start the day informed. Sign up for our morning newsletter, Top of the World, on our website, theworld.org/newsletters. Again, that's theworld.org/newsletters. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.